Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I would like to dedicate today's program to Sam Oakland. He was an exceptionally varied and intellectually engaged man, foremost a teacher, but also, as many said of him, a political gadfly, who was a vigorous but never elected candidate for various Oregon politics. I always enjoyed talking and arguing with him. And sort of ironically, if not coincidentally, this program is about another dead person. In some respects, two dead persons. Kurt Cobain, who committed suicide on April 5th, 1994, which was 20 years ago this coming Saturday, and a Vietnam veteran, Louis B. Puller, who committed suicide on May 11th that year. A retired Navy friend who knew I had been a Vietnam Marine treated me to cognac in honor of Puller. I mentioned Cobain's suicide. "You can't compare them," my friend retorted. He inspired the following imaginary dialogue, which I printed in the May 1994 Times Eagle, which was a newspaper I used to publish. And this is in tribute to both Cobain and Puller. I call it "The Poet of Alienation Meets Chesty Jr.," a dialogue in suicide. And I guess I should give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion in all of the cosmos, which, in a sense, this little dialogue takes place in. I start with a quote by Michael Herr. "The war and the music ran power off the same circuit. Rock stars started falling like second lieutenants." The two characters in this dialogue, Kurt Cobain, a rock museum, and Louis Puller Jr., a Vietnam War veteran and writer, sit together at a table in a bar somewhere. Nowhere. Who knows why? Who cares? Puller is 48. He has no legs. Parts of his arms are missing, and most of one hand. Cobain is 27. He has all his parts. Puller drinks whiskey. Cobain champagne. Each has a bottle and a glass. The time is just before now. Cobain: "Vietnam means nothing to me. I was just a kid when you got blown up. You can suck up all the BS you want from it, but I'm not impressed. I've got my own problems, and they're here and now, not from some old war." Puller: "You can't compare my experience with yours." Cobain: "Why can't I? Your legs are gone, most of your arms, so you think you're the only one who has a right to sympathy? My soul's shot. I don't want to live anymore. So what's the difference?" Puller: "You magnify your despair. Compared to me, you're in the pink of health." Cobain shakes his head. "I'm crippled more than you are. Up here," taps his head. "I want to terminate. It's not fun anymore. I want out." Puller: "I feel that way, too. I used to have a lot to live for. Now, nothing. I used to want to be a hero. Now I don't even have the guts to kill myself." Cobain: "It don't take guts. You just got to really want to do it." Puller: "Then why aren't you dead?" Cobain: "I would be if my wife hadn't interfered a few weeks ago. Man, I was almost there. Champagne and a carload of pills. She found me on the floor and got a doctor. She said I was already blue. That was in Rome, far away from Aberdeen, Washington. That's where I want to be, far away from Aberdeen." Puller: "Why are you so hot to die?" Cobain: "Suicide's the Cobain family curse. Two of my uncles ate their guns. Not too much functional going on in my family. The usual schizo crap. Drugs, booze, divorce. I used to draw pictures of my parents on the wall and wrote, 'Dad sucks. Mom sucks.' We're all alkies or junkies, and we screw up our marriages. Puller, you a heroin addict? Cobain, defensively, I'm a junkie because my stomach hurts all the time. Puller holds up his glass in mock salute. I'm an alky because I got no legs. Cobain, I was messed around with as a kid. Puller, I wasn't. I love my father. Cobain, bullshit. Nobody loves their father. Puller, I was a Marine because my dad, Chesty Puller, was a Marine. People always shook his hand and said they were proud to touch him. He was a great American hero. I felt the only way people would like me was to be a hero like my father. He went through a dozen wars and never got a scratch. He was awarded 5 Navy Crosses, a bucket full of Silver Stars and Bronze Stars. He was a general when he retired, the most decorated Marine in history. I was a brand new second lieutenant in my first war and got blown to pieces. I should have died. Instead, modern medicine made an extraordinary effort to save me and shamed me into thinking I should help out when all I wanted to do was die. Cobain. Music was my way out. The cliche, right? Broken homeboy picks up guitar, starts garage grunge band. I wrote the songs and sang them. Grungy stuff. I hate the MTV noise. Slick and schlock. My songs are real, but the music got to be the hassle. All those idiots. The phonies sucking up for money. Groupies scamming to get laid so they can tell everybody they were in bed with me. We got managers and they move in and say they own me. I like the bucks, but I hate the price. Puller, you don't like it at the top? Cobain, success kills. Yeah, never mind. I don't know what I think. I write songs and sing them. I don't ask for the contracts or other BS. I mean, I want people to hear my music, to appreciate what I put out. I don't want the BS. The bottom line, idiots and jerks. The plankton like the two wastes of sperm who raped a girl while singing our song, Polly. Poets don't get famous until they're dead. They're lucky. I'm dead before I'm dead. Number one, and it's all nirvana after that. Yeah, right. Everybody chopping me up like pieces of the true cross. Everybody grabs a piece of me, and they want more, 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 stinking more. He is quiet, moody, stares belligerently at nothing, continues. You make the music your way at first because nobody's listening. Nobody's paying attention. Then orgasm. You spray all over the idiots. They want you real bad all of a sudden, like you made them pregnant and they don't want an abortion. They didn't even know you messed with them until they were pregnant. Then they scream. You're the father and the bastard at the same time. So you have to feed them with yourself or they'll die. And it's all your fault if they live or die. Gulps champagne. You know what I said to them? I said, if any of you plankton in any way hate homosexuals, people of different color, or women, please do this one favor for us. Leave us the hell alone. Puller, running a platoon in combat is something like that. I mean, it's different, but it's similar in that 40 young men depended on me to keep them alive. It's a paradox. On the one hand, I had to be gung-ho and lead them into situations no one who is sane would wish to be, and at the same time keep their precious butts whole and secure, which is impossible. You and I have in common people's expectations. You're supposed to represent a certain generational angst. I was responsible for leading men into sure death and keep them alive. Knocks back a shot. I stepped on a landmine. I wish I'd been killed on the spot. I felt as if I'd been airborne forever. I had no idea the pink mist that engulfed me was caused by the vaporization of my right and left legs. Doctors told me my survival was a miracle. I drank and thought about suicide. Then I straightened out my act. I did pretty good for a while. I quit drinking. I thought maybe I could overcome my absolute uselessness as a human being. I tried to believe life was worth being alive. I mean, just simply living was what counted, even if half my body was missing. I retained my mind after all. My wife sticks with me. I have very famous friends. I received a Pulitzer Prize for a book I wrote. But for all that, I'm outside. I tried to get into politics. Carpentry's out, right? But voters kept me out. I got back slaps for my book about my father. But that was over real quick. Friends try to make me feel I've got something to offer, but even they don't believe it. I'm a cripple. Maybe I'm a famous cripple. An interesting grotesque, like Quasimodo. But nobody thinks I've got anything to give them. I'm just a bad memory of the past, which nobody really wants to remember or think about. Pours a shot, throws it back, pours another, does the same. You're an outsider, but I'm an insider. Ever since I was born. Maybe it's hard for you to be outside, but you've made a career out of it. Me, I'm lost outside. It's not my mind or anything like that that makes me an outsider. It's my broken body, the fact that I'm less than half a man, a tragic misfortune everybody acknowledges, but that's all. I'm dropped from any consideration of being a player. Cobain, irrelevantly. You know, I could have been a serial killer. Artists and serial killers are supposed to share some of the same trials. Broken homes. Messed up childhoods. Alienation. I'm the poet of alienation. Absolutely. But I'm suicidal. The only person I want to kill is me. Puller. Are you saying all that nihilistic despair you sing about is your loss of your father? Cobain. Absolutely. Soap opera stuff. I ain't got no papa. I hate him because he's gone. I hate everything because he's gone. Eventually commit suicide, like my uncles. Puller. My father was my hero. I was proud to be his son. I only hated him after I got blown up. He survived a dozen wars without a wound. My first turnout, and I'm disintegrated. I didn't think it was fair. I thought I was payback for his luck. I stopped hating him when I realized my mutilation was actually killing him. I was his fatal wound. Cobain. I've got a daughter. Puller says nothing. Cobain. Her name's Frances Bean. Awesome name, yeah? She's 19 months old. I've tried to make sure she knows she's got a dad and that her parents aren't just a couple of junkies. Puller. But you'll leave her. By suicide, I mean. Cobain does not respond. Puller. I hate myself and I want to die. You wrote that song. Cobain. That song made people think I was a pissy, complaining, freaked out schizophrenic who wants to kill himself all the time. They're right. Puller. If you self-destruct, thousands of people will be affected. Your funeral will be as crowded as Rudolph Valentino's and John Lennon's. Maybe a few of your more eccentric fans will copycat you. If I suicide, I might still be allowed a USMC funeral, buried alongside Chesty, with a flag given to my wife. For my epitaph, I would like inscribed, to the list of names of victims of the Vietnam War, add the name of Lewis Puller. He suffered terrible wounds that never healed. Cobain inserts pills into his mouth and swallows them with champagne. Puller. The obits will call me Chesty Puller, Jr. They might even call me a hero, if being blown apart is a heroic act. Certainly not the suicide. But whatever else they say, all of them will be sure to say that I'm Chesty Puller's boy. I've lived under his reputation my entire life. Most of the time I've been proud of it. But when I was in the USMC, everybody was curious if I measured up to my old man. Everything I did was compared to him. Whatever I did right, it was because I was Chesty's boy. Nothing of my own ability. My errors indicated I wasn't as good as Chesty. I even felt myself that I would never be as good as my father. 5 Navy crosses? I feel the only way I could measure up to Chesty was get killed. Well, I was killed. Just a few dying cells remaining. Drinks from the whiskey bottle. Cobain offers pills to Puller, who declines. Puller waits for Cobain to say something. Cobain swallows pills, puts down his champagne glass, and drinks from the bottle. Puller, I think you and I might very likely exterminate our miserable lives. Cobain, you hold a shotgun under my chin, and I'll stick a pistol in your ear. Puller, a very long drink from the whiskey bottle. Let's do it. Kurt Cobain committed suicide on April 5th, 1994. Lewis Puller suicided May 11th that year. The book he wrote, Favorite Son, The Healing of a Vietnam Vet, was dedicated to his father, Lewis B. Puller, Sr. And I'd like to continue this, which I know is not my usual route of a program. But the New York Times put out a pretty good piece about Cobain, written by Dave Seminara. It's called Kurt Cobain Slept Here, and I'd like to read it. Kurt Cobain felt bored and old. Teenage angst had paid off well, as the line in the Nirvana song "Serve the Servants" put it, but the fame that came with being the frontman of the seminal grunge band that brought punk to the mainstream was taking a toll. Cobain was considered by many to be the voice of his generation, but he was also battling depression and addiction, diseases that led to his suicide at 27. I was a 21-year-old college student at the time, and one of my fellow DJs at our college radio station, WXVU at Villanova University, relayed the grim news. We took to the airwaves playing our favorite Nirvana songs and mourning the loss with pony kegs of the best beer we could afford. In the 20 years since Cobain died, Nirvana's music has stayed with me, flashing back at me in waves, poignant reminders of my own 20s. When I read that Cobain's hometown, Aberdeen, was planning a day to honor him in February in advance of the 20-year anniversary of his death on April 5, 1994, and that Nirvana was being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in April this month, the reality that one of my favorite musicians has now been dead for 2 decades was unsettling. I had wanted to make a trip to Washington State to see where he came from and what influenced him. Because there are no organized Nirvana tours, I created my own using Heavier Than Heaven, Charles Cross's masterful Cobain biography, to create an itinerary that I hoped would give me a better understanding of Cobain and his music. I started my Cobain trip at the Marco Polo, a no-frills motel on the gritty periphery of Seattle that Cobain frequented in his final days when his heroin addiction controlled his life. According to the 2007 BBC documentary, The Last 48 Hours of Kurt Cobain, Cobain used to duck out of his mansion in the exclusive Denny Blaine neighborhood to meet one of his preferred heroin dealers along Aurora Avenue. He would then retreat to room 226 of the Marco Polo to shoot up. The reception area was closed when I arrived late on a Monday night in February, so I rang the doorbell. Moments later, a small sliding window opened and a man named Jonathan popped his head out. He sized me up wordlessly, slid the window shut, and reemerged moments later in the reception area, wearing an undershirt, a pair of boxer shorts, and woolly socks. "This place was the Wild West when Kurt stayed here," he said, checking me into Cobain's favorite room as a TV blared from his living quarters behind the reception desk. "We had hookers throwing TVs out the windows here, drug dealers, junkies, you name it." Having worked there for many years, but not back then, he suggested that the neighborhood had improved since Cobain frequented the place, but my room was a grim time warp. There were hairs on the pillows, splotchy stains on the sheets that could have predated Nirvana, and scratchy bath towels. Before buying the expansive home at 171 Lake Washington Boulevard, where he was found dead, Cobain and his wife Courtney Love lived in a variety of high-end Seattle hotels, including the Inn at the Market, the Sorrento Hotel, and the Four Seasons Olympic, now the Fairmont Olympic. The Fairmont and the other luxury hotels Cobain lived at don't advertise the connection, but the arty Hotel Max embraces Seattle's grunge connections with a sub-pop floor devoted to the local indie record label that discovered Nirvana. Cobain is often linked to Seattle, but he spent less than 2 years living in the city. He lived in more than a half dozen homes and slept in countless other places in Aberdeen and the neighboring towns of Montesano and Hoquiam, and wrote many of Nirvana's best-known songs in Olympia before moving to Seattle in 1992. I started my Cobain Homes tour in Montesano, a small town where members of the influential punk band The Melvins grew up. Standing outside 413 Fleet Street South, the home that Cobain lived in with his father from late 1978 to March 1982, was a neighbor named John Bell, who told me that when Cobain's mom used to visit him, he could hear them yelling at each other from across the street. Fleet Street was a step up for Cobain, but Mr. Bell said that the modest, century-old house with red vinyl siding and newspapers covering the windows seemed mostly empty. A few minutes outside Montesano, I drove into the Country Estates Mobile Home Park, where Cobain lived with his paternal grandfather, Leland Cobain, after leaving Fleet Street, while parked next to a speed limit sign that warned, "Violators will be prosecuted. Survivors will be shot." A man named Jerry, who was out for a walk, offered to introduce me to Gary Cobain, Leland's son and Kurt's uncle. "My dad greeted Nirvana fans from all over the world here," said Gary Cobain, who moved into the mobile home after his father died last May. It kept him busy. Shadowing the Chehalis River, I drove west from Seattle along Olympic Highway to Aberdeen, an old logging city once called the roughest town west of the Mississippi. Before a tableau of billowing smokestacks, there is a sign erected by the Kurt Cobain Memorial Foundation in 2005 that reads, "Welcome to Aberdeen, come as you are," a reference to one of Nirvana's hit singles and now the unofficial motto of the city. The mayor of Aberdeen, Bill Simpson, had offered to take me on a mini Nirvana tour, but the receptionist at City Hall said he was helping to negotiate a standoff. "There's some crazy guy holed up in his attic who fired some shots out the window and was making threats," she explained. Before I could tell her not to bother the mayor, she had already spoken to him, and minutes later he bounded into the room. "Kurt went to Seattle and became famous, but he was from Aberdeen," the mayor told me as we piled into his Chrysler minivan. "Seattle embraced him as one of their own, but then he killed himself, and suddenly he became an Aberdeen guy again. We're happy to reclaim him." We drove by 1210 East 1st Street to have a look at the home where Cobain lived for several years as a child in the city's notorious Felony Flats neighborhood, which is rife with boarded-up homes. His mother, Wendy O'Connor, who now lives in California, placed the 4-bedroom modest home, assessed at $67,000, up for sale in September at $500,000. Jamie Dunkel, a Nirvana fan in Portland, Oregon, is raising money to turn the place into a museum so it doesn't end up in the clutches of capitalist greed, as she put it on her website. A real estate agent gave me a tour of the home, which is being marketed as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to own a piece of rock history. It was like a stroll into a 1970s time warp. The vintage kitchen featured orange, black, and gold carpeting. The hallway had wood shingles, and Cobain's bedroom was just as he left it, with a hole punched in the wall and plenty of graffiti paying homage to bands he liked, Led Zeppelin, Iron Maiden, and perhaps his favorite beer, Old English 800. A former manager of the men's shoe department at Aberdeen's J.C. Penney store, Mayor Simpson, who is 73, isn't in the heart of the Nirvana fan demographic, but when I dialed up Territorial Pissings, the most aggressively punk Nirvana tunes I could find on my iPhone, he insisted that he liked it. While we were checking out the recently unveiled and much maligned Kurt Cobain statue, a not very flattering rendition of Cobain in ripped jeans with a tear falling from one eye at the Aberdeen History Museum, Mayor Simpson took a call and relayed the news that the standoff was over. "Good news. The guy surrendered," he said. Aberdeen's must-see Cobain site is a small park opened in 2011 by the Kurt Cobain Memorial Foundation called Kurt Cobain Landing, which sits at the foot of the Yonge Street Bridge, the inspiration for the song Something in the Way. Cobain claimed that he lived under the bridge for a time, and while most who knew him don't think he did, it was clearly one of his preferred hangouts. Set along the banks of the murky Wishkah River, the strangely appealing little park features a guitar sculpture, a likeness of Cobain with the lyrics to Something in the Way, a headstone with some amusing Cobain quotes, sample, "I'm a walking bacterial infection," a Kurt Cobain air guitar sculpture, and a collage of Nirvana-related graffiti under the bridge itself. After the tour, I checked out a host of Nirvana-related sites, including 6 different homes where he once lived. I knew that Cobain had grown up poor, but seeing all of the places where he lived, including Dale Crover's porch at 609 West 2nd Street, where he slept inside a refrigerator box for a time, gave me a new appreciation for how much he overcame. Surely no one who knew Kurt Cobain then could have predicted that someday he'd have 2 towns fighting to claim him as a native son. Hoquiam, Aberdeen's neighbor and rival, issued a proclamation honoring Nirvana in February, prompting Aberdeen to reclaim Kurt with a Cobain Day of its own. The home where he lived in Hoquiam from birth until he was 2 looked just as forlorn as most of his residences in Aberdeen, but Hoquiam also had an appealing, if dated, little downtown. 2 months after playing their first ever gig at a house party in Raymond, Cobain left Aberdeen and moved to Olympia, a comparatively bohemian oasis where he found his creative muse. My first stop was 114 Pear Street, a small house in central Olympia, split into 3 apartments, where Cobain lived with Tracy Mirander, his girlfriend at the time. She supported him while he wrote many of the songs that would appear on Nevermind. They broke up, but he kept their tiny apartment until July 1991, when he returned from doing promotional work in Los Angeles for the forthcoming Nevermind, to find that he'd been evicted, his belongings discarded in the street like trash. Scott Taylor, the lead singer and guitar player for The Hard Way, lives in apartment number 3, where Cobain wrote Nirvana's most recognizable songs, and he offered me a tour. Inside the compact one-bedroom apartment, Mr. Taylor has a Nirvana poster featuring a photo of Cobain posing in what is now Mr. Taylor's backyard, and another photo of the band playing an early gig. The fact that a musician is bathing in the same black clawfoot tub Cobain used to pass out in isn't a huge coincidence. For a small city, Olympia's music scene is as vibrant as they come. At the old school McMenamin's Spar Cafe, where he reportedly liked to hang out, I asked my waitress Heidi about Cobain's connection to Olympia. "Kurt lived at the house I live in now," she said. "He lived everywhere, but got kicked out of each place." On my way back to Seattle, Nirvana tunes rattling in my rented Corolla, I felt that trying to follow in Cobain's footstep was a lot like chasing a shadow. That was nowhere so more so than in Seattle itself, which has changed almost beyond recognition since he died. Bruce Pavitt, the founder of the Sub Pop record label, which signed Nirvana, and the author of Experiencing Nirvana, Grunge in Europe, 1989, told me that the one Seattle venue where Nirvana played that has largely stayed the same is the Central Saloon, the city's oldest bar, established in 1892. Most rock historians consider a show Nirvana played at the Vogue, now a hair salon, the band's first Seattle gig, but Mr. Pavitt insisted that a Nirvana showcase he attended on April 10, 1988, at the Central Saloon was the band's very first. "No one else remembers it," he said, "because it was just me, the doorman, and about 3 other people." The Central is still a grand old tavern, but when I visited in late February, it was filled with a well-dressed, affluent crowd. Other notable Nirvana venues in Seattle include the Crocodile, a once grungy club that has now been renovated, the OK Hotel, where the band first played Smells Like Teen Spirit, now an upscale condo, and Beehive Records, where Nirvana played a legendary in-store concert just before the release of Nevermind. It is now a Petco store. Linda's Tavern, a celebrated neighborhood bar nicknamed the Grunge Cheers, was where Cobain was last seen alive. Tiny Verretta Park, adjacent to the imposing estate on Lake Washington Boulevard that Cobain and Ms. Love moved into less than 4 months before his death, along with their daughter, Frances Bean Cobain, also has endured. Nirvana fans from around the world come to etch graffiti in the park's lone bench or leave flowers, even though the city of Seattle has refused to rename the place Kurt Cobain Park. Walking behind the Denny Blaine neighborhood, the last place where Cobain lived, I felt that Aberdeen's most famous son never really fit in with Seattle anyway, certainly not in this exclusive area. I sat on the unofficial Cobain bench and thought about how the Cobain haunts in Seattle, Olympia, and Aberdeen mirrored the big picture of what's happened to these places. Olympia is artier than it used to be, with struggling musicians everywhere, even in Cobain's old apartment. The dilapidated Cobain childhood homes in Aberdeen spoke to the depressing reality that many young people there are still trying to escape, perhaps now even more than before. The fact that most of the grungy places were never played in Seattle are either gone or completely different is a testament to the continued gentrification of the city. As these thoughts swirled in my head, the words to a song I had heard during an open mic at Tugboat Annie's in Olympia the night before popped into my head. A diminutive bearded rapper named MC Swamp Tiger played Peace, a song whose final lines sung, no, screamed, with conviction, made me think of Cobain. In my death, I finally found my peace. In my death, I finally found my peace. I said, in my death, I finally found my peace. And that was Kurt Cobain Slept Here, a quest to understand the life and death of a rock legend where he lived and played, by Dave Seminara. And it appeared in the Sunday, March 30th, 2014, New York Times, and you might not be too surprised, in the travel section. though this has been a little bit of a departure of my usual type of show, it yet fits in very well. And this has been Michael McCusker. I might be here next week if I don't fall into the river, if drones don't incinerate me somewhere, or if somebody runs me down in a not very well-marked crosswalk here in Astoria, like they seem to have been trying to do the last couple of months, and I don't take it personally. And this has been Michael McCusker. As I said, I might very well be here next Thursday if certain things do not occur, and I just might be seeing you next week.